It was being used for a very important, very quiet meeting. When Harvath rolled up, he saw three heavily armored black Suburbans parked in front. Even in casual clothes, the detail agents posted outside gave off a serious, don't fuck with us vibe. Intensity was an important prerequisite for the job. Even more important were experience and ability. Terrorists the world over would have loved nothing more than to get their hands on the two people inside. Parking his Tahoe in the grass, Harvath shook hands with the lead agent, a man named Haggerty, and chatted with him for a few seconds. Haggerty had gone to Notre Dame, which Harvath, as a University of Southern California grad, always explained wasn't the man's fault. It was obvious that his parents hadn't cared much for him. It was a good-natured ribbing born from a storied college rivalry. Haggerty was confident about the football team Notre Dame was fielding this year, so confident, in fact, that he wanted to place a wager on the game against USC. After reminding him of the Code of Federal Regulations banning gambling in the federal workplace, Harvath smiled and agreed to $100. "Cash," Haggerty clarified. "None of that Bitcoin crap." Harvath laughed and they shook hands. Turning, he climbed the three slate steps to the lockhouse and knocked. "Come in," a voice replied. "It's open." Harvath entered to find the CIA director, Bob McGee, and the deputy director, Lydia Ryan, at a weathered wooden table in the living room. McGee was in his early 60s. He had wavy dark hair, which was rapidly going all gray. His most distinctive feature, though, was his thick mustache. You didn't see a lot of those in Washington, and even fewer in government. Ryan was a gorgeous woman. She was the 5'10" product of an Irish father and a Greek mother. She had long black hair and deep green eyes. Both McGee and Ryan had come from the clandestine service side of the CIA. They were smart, seasoned, no-bullshit people. The president had chosen them specifically to clean out the dead wood at Langley and bring the agency back to its former glory.
"There's coffee in the kitchen," Ryan said, as Harvath stepped inside.
Walking back to the kitchen, he grabbed an enamel mug from one of the cupboards and poured himself a cup. Returning to the living room, he joined McGee and Ryan at the table. It was covered with files. They had been meeting like this a lot, outside CIA headquarters, on nights and weekends. The less people knew about what they were up to, the better. Like a ruptured appendix, terrorism had exploded, gushing its poison in all directions. Attacks were on the rise everywhere, especially in Europe, and now in the United States as well. Losing territory and suffering defeat after defeat, ISIS had become like a cornered, wounded animal. In desperation, it had lashed out, calling for attacks on Americans whenever and wherever they could be found. They were sending a very clear message. Nowhere was safe. In return, the American president had sent a very clear message of his own. There wasn't a rock big enough for ISIS to crawl under or a hole deep enough to slither down. Wherever its members tried to hide, the United States would find them. All of them. America would hunt its enemies to the very ends of the earth, and it would be relentless in doing so. The problem, though, was that not everyone in the U.S. agreed with the president. Some saw his approach as too antagonistic. They worried that he was giving the terrorists exactly what they wanted, that he was playing right into their hands. They wanted less cowboy and more samurai, wise, patient, striking only when absolutely necessary, and then slipping back into the night. Then there were those who didn't want any strikes at all. They claimed that hitting back only perpetuated a cycle of violence. They cautioned that if we didn't stop, neither would ISIS. The already bad situation would only grow worse. Many felt that the president didn't appreciate their opinions and hadn't even bothered to take them into consideration. But those who knew him, that small circle with whom he kept counsel, knew that wasn't the case at all. The president didn't like waging this battle.
But it was a just war. The use of force was not something he took lightly. His greatest desire was peace. He wanted nothing more than the security of the American people. He saw the safety of Americans at home and abroad as his number one responsibility as commander-in-chief. It was the duty he placed above all others. He was also privy to something his fellow citizens were not. Every morning, he received an intelligence briefing, which laid out how truly dangerous organizations like ISIS and Al-Qaeda were. They were fanatics who believed that they had been chosen to rule the earth. For that to happen, they had to subjugate America and her allies through jihad. Anything less than total commitment to this goal was an act of defiance against God himself. The fundamentalism that drove them was a cancer. It infected almost everyone it touched. And yet the people best positioned to remove the cancer lacked the courage and the desire to do so. No matter how many atrocities were committed in the name of their religion and their God, the Muslim world was wholly incapable of combating the problem. With so little cooperation, the president had been left with few choices, and those choices only narrowed as many of America's allies were overwhelmed with resource shortages and tidal waves of radicals on their own soil. While the president respected those American voices that disagreed with his position, he could already see over the horizon. He could see what was coming if the United States didn't act. Like Israelis, Americans would find themselves in a state of constant siege. Beaches, restaurants, trains, buses, nightclubs, grocery stores, schools, playgrounds, dog parks, movie theaters, sporting events, parades, shopping malls, even the places where they worshipped, nothing would be off limits. And as the attacks mounted, a frightened population would demand that something be done. There would be armed guards and security checkpoints everywhere, and even that would not be enough to deter America's enemies. The terrorists would strike as Americans dropped their children off at school, or stood in line waiting to step through a body scanner at the latest Broadway show. It simply wasn't possible to keep all of America safe all of the time. The calls to do more, though, would only grow. Finally, the bureaucrats and politicians would step in and attempt to regulate terrorism away. At that point, America would take a very dangerous turn. As Ben Franklin was alleged to have said, "Those who would trade a little liberty for a little security deserve neither and will lose both." That, in a nutshell, was the president's greatest fear. So he decided to act. Despite using much of his political capital to push through a dramatic increase to the FBI's budget, the Bureau was drowning. It had active investigations in all 50 states, but still nowhere near the resources it needed to see each investigation through to its end. The terrorists were coming at them too quickly, from everywhere and every walk of life. There simply were too many cases, too many leads, and not nearly enough agents. The president had been left with only one course of action, a course that, if made known, would very likely lead to his impeachment. Looking at Harvath, McGee said, "Let's talk about what happened at Burning Man." Chapter 8. Harvath was operating on a black contract. Technically, none of what he was doing should ever see the light of day. But in the age of hackers and leaked documents, he went to extraordinary lengths to make sure he put little, if anything, in writing. Administrations changed, as did opinions on what the CIA should or should not be doing. What was justified in the weeks and months after the September 11 attacks might take on a different light when re-examined from some point in the future. As far as Harvath was concerned, the best way to avoid being judged by history was not to be a part of it to begin with. Harvath understood the president's position. He had deep feelings about individual liberty. He also cared about keeping Americans safe. He had seen the utter barbarism of groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda up close. He had witnessed what they had done to their victims, including women and children. One of the most painful moments of his career was rescuing the kidnapped son of an Iraqi policeman, only to have the little boy die in his arms. The torture the child had been subjected to was beyond horrific. There were only so many dark corners in a person's mind to hide such experiences. It was why, from time to time, Harvath needed to be alone with a couple of six-packs or a bottle of bourbon. Long runs and pushing heavy stacks of weights brought him only so much relief. It wasn't the healthiest way to deal with things, but unfortunately, the human mind didn't have a delete button. Sometimes, if only for a little while, he just needed to forget. It was a terrible burden to drag around, but it was part of the job. Without someone to hunt the wolves, the sheep would never be safe. The wolves were multiplying too quickly. The sheepdogs were being overrun. It was a matter of survival. So when the president had decided to alter America's rules of engagement, Harvath had agreed to go along. Those new rules of engagement were what had placed him at Burning Man, operating without official sanction. There just weren't enough fingers and toes at the FBI to plug all the leaks springing from the terrorism dike. Whenever possible, the CIA shared its intelligence with the Bureau. Too often, though, that intelligence was placed on the back burner. It wasn't their fault. They were being forced to drink from a fire hose. With the president's quiet encouragement, Langley had begun to develop, plan, and execute more operations on its own. Depending on your point of view, Burning Man had been either a spectacular success or a spectacular failure. Listening to Harvath's debriefing, McGee and Ryan both saw the op as a success. Had the other bombers been able to detonate, many more people would have been killed and injured. No one, not even Harvath, had known it was an active plot until moments before it had gone off. Even if they had shared their mountain of intelligence with the FBI, it would have taken too long for them to assign a surveillance team to Hamza Rahim.
"Once the plane lifted off from Black Rock City Airport," Harvath said, wrapping up his report, "I went to work on them. You know the rest."
Yes, they did. Rahim had been extremely uncooperative. Harvath had quickly ratcheted up the pressure, playing on the would-be bomber's fear of being returned to his native Egypt. Harvath convinced Rahim that not only did their jet have the capacity to make the flight, but also that the Egyptians would gladly accept him and help get the information he wanted out of him. Rahim knew all too well how the Egyptians operated. He had been viciously tortured by their secret police before. He had no desire to experience it again. No matter what the Americans had in store for him, it couldn't be worse than going back to Egypt. So he had slowly begun to cooperate, revealing how the attack had been planned, financed, and why he had returned to the RV. To avoid detection, the materials for the suicide vests had been smuggled in separately and assembled on site. The bomb maker, though, had become nervous. Rahim was concerned that he might be having second thoughts and was worried he'd be captured after the attack. It was a business decision, no more, no less. The bomb maker was a loose end that had needed tying up. Rahim and the other cell members had been transferred to a secret facility in Colorado for further interrogation. As soon as the handoff was complete, the jet had flown Harvath and his team to D.C., where they had gone their separate ways. Though Harvath was renting a place in Boston to be closer to his girlfriend and her family, he hadn't officially given up his house in Virginia. It was along the Potomac River, close to George Washington's Mount Vernon estate. Most of the furniture was gone, but he'd left just enough behind to make it livable. If nothing else, it was good to be home and to shower off the playa dust and toss all of his clothes in the washer. He'd been in the midst of arranging to return to Boston when he had gotten the call about a meeting at the Blue Lock House. He figured the main point would be deciding what to do next about the ISIS plotters who had tasked Rahim with the attack.
"So, what's next?" asked Harvath. "The refugee camp where the cell members were recruited?
McGee shook his head. We're putting somebody else on that.
Somebody else? Why?
This is why, the director replied, as he opened a file, removed a photograph, and handed it to him. Harvath studied the photo.
His name is Mustafa Marzouk, said Ryan, taking over the briefing. He was a graduate student in chemistry from Tunisia. 3 years ago, during a raid on an ISIS compound by a CIA-backed rebel group in Syria, a laptop was found. At first, no one thought anything of it. It wasn't password-protected and all the drives were empty. But then, we started drilling down on it and discovered over 146 gigabytes of hidden material. Among the more than 35,000 files were all the usual things you'd expect to find on a laptop in an ISIS stronghold. Justifications for jihad, military manuals, terror videos, etc. Then came the interesting stuff. Document after document, showing that the laptop's owner was researching weapons of mass destruction. From the minute she had mentioned chemistry, Harvath had begun to develop a bad feeling.
Let me guess, the laptop's owner is Mustafa Marzouk.
Ryan nodded.
Correct. For 3 years we've been looking for him. Syria, Iraq, Libya, Tunisia. We even followed an alleged sighting in Somalia. Everything, though, has turned up empty.
So why are we talking about him now?
Over the last several months, we've been picking up chatter about an impending series of attacks, culminating in something very big, somewhere in Europe.
Any clue as to what that something very big is?
The laptop contained a 30-page fatwa from an obscure, jailed Saudi cleric justifying the use of chemical and biological weapons.
Harvath felt a chill sweep over him. Ryan opened the folder in front of her and read from the Islamic ruling.
If Muslims cannot defeat the unbelievers in a different way, it is permissible to use weapons of mass destruction, even if it kills all of them and wipes them and their descendants off the face of the earth.
For a moment, Harvath was at a loss for words.
I'm guessing the Saudis didn't pick him up for unpaid parking tickets.
No, they didn't. He was turning into a problem. They decided to act before he developed any more of a following. The damage, though, has already been done. Mixed within the chatter have been references to the same fatwa from the same obscure cleric.
So you want me to find this Mustafa Marzouk? Is that it?
Not exactly, replied McGee, as he removed another photo and handed it to him. It showed a bloated corpse with chunks of flesh ripped away. Mustafa Marzouk is dead. The Italian Navy fished his body out of the Mediterranean yesterday, near the island of Lampedusa. They're not sure if he drowned before or after the sharks got to him. Not that it makes much difference. We had his fingerprints from the laptop. Despite his having spent several days in the water, they were still able to ID him. He was on a smuggler's boat packed with migrants headed towards Sicily. The boat went down in a storm Tuesday night. Harvath handed the photo back.
For 3 years, this guy has been a ghost, bouncing around the Middle East, North Africa, and Somalia. Then he suddenly hops on a boat to Italy? Why?
That's what we need you to find out. We think whatever he was planning, it's ready to go operational.
When do you want me to launch?
ASAP, McGee replied. We've got a plane standing by. All you need to do is tell it where to go.
Let's start with whatever intel you've compiled.
The director slid a stack of files toward him. These don't leave this room.
Understood. What else do you need?
At the top of his list, he needed to call Lara. He wouldn't be back to Boston anytime soon. He was also hungry. Looking at his watch, he said,
Let's order some food. We're going to be here a while.
Chapter 9. Always prepared, McGee and Ryan had brought their encrypted laptops. Whatever information Harvath needed beyond the files, they were able to retrieve via a secure link back to Langley. Slowly, he developed three different plans. The first two were immediately shot down. They weren't crazy about the third one either. As capable as Harvath was, it put him in very hostile territory without backup. It was, though, their only viable option. Reluctantly, McGee agreed, but with one condition. He wasn't sending Harvath into that hellhole alone. Removing his cell phone, he stepped into the other room to get the ball rolling on all of the things Harvath had asked for. Ryan was left sitting at the table. She cleared her throat. Harvath looked up from the folder he was studying.
"I was hoping for a better time to tell you this," she said. "I'm leaving the agency."
He didn't believe it.
"You're kidding."
"No, I'm serious."
"Does the president know?"
She nodded.
"McGee?"
She nodded again.
"It was their idea."
He closed the folder and set it on the table.
"I don't understand. You were tapped to help fix it. How do you walk away from that responsibility?"
"I'm going to head the Carlton Group."
Harvath was stunned.
"My organization?"
Ryan raised an eyebrow in response. The Carlton Group had been Harvath's organization, or more appropriately, it had been the organization he had spent the last several years working for. It was a private intelligence organization, founded by one of the founders of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. Reed Carlton, a legendary spymaster, with more than 30 years in the business, had gotten fed up with all of the bureaucratic red tape at Langley and had left to start his own company. When a previous president had cut Harvath loose, Carlton had recruited him. He had become Harvath's mentor, teaching him everything he knew. And then he took the collar off and unleashed him on America's enemies. Theirs was a formidable pairing. Harvath was an apex predator, and Carlton was one of the greatest strategic thinkers the intelligence world had ever known. Together, they were unstoppable. The old man, as Harvath referred to him, had always envisioned Scott as his successor and had groomed him to one day take over the Carlton Group. The only problem was that Harvath wasn't interested in that job. He loved being in the field. If the truth be told, he was addicted to the action. He had also met someone. With Lara and her little boy Marco, he had a real chance for a family, something he had always wanted. When Lara received a major promotion, cementing her need to remain in Boston, he had had a choice to make, and choose he did. He chose to walk away from D.C. The old man had encouraged him to go, but had also refused his resignation.
"Let's see what happens," he had said.
Harvath continued to take contract work from the agency, the best part being that he could say no. As far as he was concerned, he had the three necessary ingredients to happiness: something to do, someone to love, and something to look forward to. With the revelation that Ryan had taken the position meant for him, he felt a ripple of guilt. He knew he had let the old man down. Nevertheless, he had made the right decision for himself and his own future. He was sure of that.
"Congratulations," he offered.
"Thanks.
But why now? And why the push from McGee and President Porter?"
Ryan leaned back in her chair.
"It's complicated."
"It's always complicated."
"I don't know that I should go into it."
"Go into what?"
She took a deep breath and exhaled.
"He's not well."
"Wait, the old man isn't well? What's wrong?"
"It's being kept quiet, but he's starting to forget things."
Harvath looked at her.
"As in dementia?"
She nodded.
"He has Alzheimer's."
It was like getting hit in the chest with a hammer.
"How long has he known?"
"What difference does it make?"
"Lydia, how long?"
he repeated.
"The diagnosis came right before you decided to go to Boston."
Harvath's ripple of guilt turned into a wave.
"He never told me."
She managed half a smile.
"He didn't want it to influence your decision."
"How bad is it?"
"He's having trouble retaining new information, but all the old stuff is right at his fingertips."
"Will it get worse?"
She nodded again.
"It typically starts with difficulty retaining new information. Then, as it moves through the brain, symptoms get more severe. Confusion about times, dates, places, and events are common, along with disorientation and deepening suspicion of friends and family. Behavior changes are often seen, and eventually there's more serious memory loss, which can be followed by the inability to speak, swallow, or walk. None of it's pretty. Smiling, Ryan added, "He's a tough son of a bitch, though. He doesn't want anybody feeling sorry for him."
"Why you, though?" Harbath asked. "Why would McGee and President Porter want to lose you at CIA?
"Because the reforms at the agency aren't going as well as we'd hoped."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning, it's like turning a battleship around."
"But you knew it would take time," he stated.
"McGee has already fired a ton of dead weight."
"Which is a good start, but it's not enough," she said. "Not with how quickly the threats are mounting. There are some absolutely terrific people at CIA, but nowhere near the numbers needed to reverse the broken culture. That's still years off."
"What's the Carlton Group's role in this supposed to be?" Harbath asked.
She thought for a second about how best to frame her response. "If the CIA needs a total gut rehab, the Carlton Group is the home we're going to live in while it's being done." The old man had always believed, and Harbath had agreed, that the CIA needed to be burned to the ground and rebuilt in the model of its predecessor, the nimbler Office of Strategic Services. With all of the bureaucratic calcification in Washington, though, he had doubted whether he'd ever live to see it happen. He knew that anyone who tried to carry out such a mission was going to get overwhelming pushback, or worse.
"You're going to tick off a lot of people."
"That's why it's being kept quiet," she replied, "along with Reed's diagnosis. I'm telling you because I think you should know."
Harbath appreciated her being straight with him. Reed Carlton had been more than just a mentor. He'd been like a father.
"What can I do?" he asked. "Does he need anything? Do you need anything?"
The list was miles long. The task she had taken on, Herculean. There was one item, though, right at the top.
"The Carlton Group needs its own special operations group."
Harbath wasn't surprised. Covert operations were a vital part of national security. One of the most counterproductive things the CIA had ever done was put its operatives in embassies around the world. Too many of them began to think like State Department employees. They brought their families along on each two-year rotation, focusing on the next promotion, while the ambassador, not the chief of station, had final say over what ops they could and couldn't conduct. It was poisonous. In an environment controlled by the State Department, diplomacy came first. Espionage, depending upon the steel of a given ambassador, came a distant second. The stories of good men and women in the clandestine service missing out on big intelligence wins because of State Department fears were legion. Trolling diplomatic cocktail parties, running low-risk recruiting operations, and waiting for foreign walk-ins all had their place. But so too did complicated, high-risk operations that offered potential windfalls. As long as Foggy Bottom was calling the shots, Langley was operating with one arm tied behind its back. If the Carlton Group was going to be a leaner, meaner version of the CIA, it would need its own special operations group. Based on the amount of work the agency had been feeding him, Harbath wasn't surprised. What did surprise him, though, was that Ryan was raising the issue with him.
"Why are we talking about this?" he asked. "The old man isn't hoping I'll lead one of the teams, is he?"
Ryan shook her head.
"No, he's hoping you'll lead the entire thing."
Harbath couldn't believe his ears.
"You're both losing your minds."
She put up her hands. "Now's not the time. Right now, you need to focus on what Mustafa Marzouk was up to. We'll talk about everything else when you get back."
They worked for several more hours, refining Harbath's plan and making several final preparations. When he stood up to leave, McGee and Ryan accompanied him outside. It had been a long day. He needed a drink and some time to process. More important, he wanted to pay a visit to the old man. Ryan, though, cautioned against it.
"See him when you get back. He'll still be here. Don't worry. She was right, but he did worry. There were few things he could think of worse than having your entire mind taken from you. It was heartbreaking. Part of him felt like he should apologize for letting the old man down, as if doing so might help reverse his Alzheimer's. It was stupid, and he knew it, but that didn't stop him from feeling it. Another part of him just wanted Carlton to know he wasn't alone. He was one of the best men Harvath had ever known. He deserved better. Ryan seemed to be able to read his thoughts. Instead of a handshake, she put her arms around him and gave him a hug. McGee shook his hand and wished him good luck. As they turned back to the lockhouse, Harvath's mind turned to what lay in front of him. Had he been paying better attention, he might have sensed the figure hidden in the woods. 200 yards away, a man was snapping photos of him with a long-lensed digital camera. Chapter 10. Sunday. Santiago de Compostela, Spain. The Catholic pilgrimage trail known as the Camino de Santiago was a vast network of routes across Europe. They culminated at Santiago's massive Romanesque cathedral, where the remains of St. James the Elder, one of the 12 apostles and patron saint of Spain, were buried. Turzanov could have picked any religious building, but this one was special. From his position on the Praça do Obradoiro, he noted the masses of tourists. The body count would be exceptional. But it wasn't just the cathedral's popularity that had appealed to him. While researching his Burning Man attack, he had come across something remarkable. Black Rock City was laid out in such a way that its central axis pointed directly to the cathedral in Santiago. He knew this wasn't an accident. His mother, a follower of the mystical strain of Sufi Islam, had always encouraged him to see the hand of the divine in all things, everywhere. It was as if Allah himself was directing him. James was also known as Santiago Matamoros, or St. James the Moor Slayer. By the time King Alfonso II of Asturias died, the Moors already controlled most of the Iberian Peninsula. A popular myth held that in return for allowing his Christian kingdom in northwest Spain to continue enjoying its autonomy, the neighboring Islamic emirate of Córdoba demanded the reinstitution of the tribute of 100 virgins, an annual payment of 50 virgins of noble birth, and 50 of common birth in return for the promise of Muslim forces not to invade. Alfonso's successor, Ramiro I, though, refused to pay, and both sides readied for war. According to legend, on the night before the battle, St. James appeared to Ramiro in a dream, reassuring him that he would be victorious. The next day, at the Battle of Clavijo, Ramiro invoked the name of St. James and with his men slew more than 5,000 of the Moorish forces. It was claimed that St. James, riding on a white horse with a white banner and a long silver sword, rode among Ramiro's men, cutting down every Muslim soldier who appeared before him. Hence, St. James became known as Matamoros, and there were paintings and statues of him performing his abhorrent deed all over the city. The attack on the cathedral that held his bones, and more important, his name, would be an undeniable victory for the Islamic State and Muslims around the world. Turzanov had planned its timing very carefully. More than 250,000 pilgrims visited the cathedral every year. August was considered peak season. He was pushing things by waiting until the end of the month, but it had been important to attack at Burning Man first. The Americans were reactionary. In light of a successful attack in Europe, they would have hardened targets, possibly making it too hard to strike. It had been better to catch them by surprise. Now, it was time to surprise the Europeans. Turzanov had attended the Pilgrims' Mass only once, but it was enough. Like everyone around him, he had filmed the entire thing with his camera phone. Based on his estimates, the service at the high altar catered to just over 1,000 worshippers, all tightly packed into the pews.
He would have loved to collapse the Cathedral of Santiago de Compostela, but with its sweeping arches, barreled ceiling, and soaring columns, its structural DNA eluded him. He didn't have the engineering expertise of a bin Laden. His experience came from his service in the Tajik Army, followed by a career in the Special Operations Unit of the National Police Force. Neither had called for taking down churches. He was much more conversant in things like artillery and blowing doors off hinges. Even so, he had tried to improve his knowledge. Using the Christian churches and heavily columned archaeological sites of ISIS-held territory, he had conducted experiment after experiment. And while the structural DNA of the sites continued to elude him, something more dramatic was revealed. With each test, they learned how to build better bombs. In particular, their martyrdom vests took a huge leap forward. As the technology improved, so did their understanding of how best to maximize the effects. Whether indoors or out, they developed a whole new approach that would accelerate the lethality of their attacks. With these advancements, he had pushed for a new way of structuring personnel. There was no need to create one operational cell. He wanted multiple small cells, with each believing it was acting alone. If one was captured, the operation would still be able to continue. In fact, authorities might even drop their guard, believing that they had successfully interrupted the entirety of the plot. It meant more work, more cutouts, and double-blind intermediaries. But Turzanov's ability to strategize on a higher plane was what had earned him his position as the senior ISIS commander for Europe. His brothers in America would have been smart to follow his lead. Opening a new package of Dunhill cigarettes, he placed one between his lips and lit it. Closing his eyes, he inhaled and tried to picture how everything would unravel inside. The highlight of the pilgrim's mass was the flight of a massive brass incense burner. Suspended high above the main altar, the cathedral's Bota Fumeiro was controlled by a series of ropes, the pulling of which caused it to soar to amazing heights as it released its sweet-smelling smoke. Turzanov imagined the quiet titter of excitement as the red-robed tiraboleiros, the men charged with lofting the frankincense-packed censer, walked past the faithful and made their way toward the altar. Once there, the lead tiraboleiro would light the Bota Fumeiro, and it would begin to release its heavy aroma. Once the other tiraboleiros were ready, the chief would give a signal, and they'd pull on the ropes in unison, dramatically launching it heavenward. As it swung back and forth in a hypnotic, pendulous motion that seemed poised to touch the walls of the cathedral itself, its intoxicating smoke would fill the air. So effortlessly would it swing, and so wonderful was its heady perfume, that the entire spectacle would seem to provide a way to commune with the divine. As the organ played, a nun would sing. Exhaling, Turzanov opened his eyes and glanced at his watch. They were seconds away. Inside, the organ would be building to a thunderous crescendo, as the lead tiraboleiro reached out to capture the swinging Bota Fumeiro. Turzanov counted down from 10 as he took another drag from his cigarette. Looking up, he fixed his eyes on the glazed windows adorning the structure's western facade. 3 seconds later, the entire city shook as a series of explosions rocked the cathedral, sending shards of stained glass, chunks of flaming stone, and pieces of bone, blood, and human flesh in all directions. Chapter 11. Al-Jamil, Libya. Monday. When news of the attack on the cathedral in Santiago de Compostela broke, the CIA had accelerated Harvath's timetable. More than 400 people had been killed, 92 of them American. 400 more people were wounded, including more than 100 Americans. The numbers were still climbing. Though the Spanish had only begun to gather intelligence, McGee and everyone back at Langley were already convinced. Santiago de Compostela was the kickoff of a series of attacks they had been worried about. And if that attack was just the beginning, things were going to get much, much worse. They needed to get ahead of this fast, or many more people were going to die.
In case nobody's on record yet, Matt Morrison stated from the front passenger seat, this is a really bad fucking idea.
The 5'11", 31-year-old former Force Reconnaissance Marine from Cullman, Alabama, kept his head on a swivel as he peered through the tinted windows. Next to him, driving, was his fellow Force Recon Marine, Mike Haney. The 40-year-old Marin, California native stood 6 feet tall. In back of the white Toyota Hiace panel van, Harvath, a Southern California native, leaned against his plate carrier and manipulated the feed from the 360-degree camera mounted to the roof. Across from him, 5'10", 39-year-old Tyler Stalen, the Delta operative from downstate Illinois, read a Brad Meltzer paperback. Trailing a block back in a blue Land Cruiser were Navy SEAL Tim Barton and 5th SFG Green Beret Jack Gage. They were all wearing civilian clothes with baseball caps, sunglasses, and keffiyehs. Even though they were all tanned, they didn't really blend in. The point, though, was to minimize how much they stood out. Harvath hadn't intended to drag his Burning Man team along with him, but McGee had insisted. Libya was one of the most dangerous places in the world. It had gone from the wealthiest country in Africa with the highest life expectancy on the continent to a failed state. These days, instead of rule by a ruthless dictator, local militias with shifting allegiances held sway. Your best friend in the morning could be your worst enemy by the afternoon. That made it difficult to conduct business and practically impossible to gather intelligence. The key to success was to stuff your pockets with carrots and carry the biggest stick anyone had ever seen. Fortunately, McGee was able to provide Harvath with access to both. As a new government of national accord was struggling to unite Libya from its capital in Tripoli, the CIA and U.S. military had been providing cover and breathing room by helping to hunt and kill Islamic militants. The last thing they wanted was for Libya to become another caliphate or pre-9/11 Afghanistan. In its multi-million-dollar game of whack-a-martyr, the CIA paid for actionable intelligence, which the United States Africa Command then used to carry out drone strikes. There was enough to keep everyone busy. But with so much at stake, no one, especially Libya's fledgling government, had time to deal with the smugglers. Paying off their local militias, they ran their businesses with virtual impunity. For one smuggler, though, that was about to change. Harvath had made it his mission to understand how they operated. What he learned made him want to kill all of them. The smugglers employed two types of vessels: decommissioned, no longer seaworthy fishing trawlers, and inflatable rubber boats. A decent-sized trawler could cram anywhere from 300 to 600, sometimes even 1,000 migrants looking to be smuggled to Italy. The rubber boats could only take 100 without sinking, but even so, they always tried to squeeze more on board. Migrants came from all over Africa and the Middle East, from places like Niger, Mali, Sudan, and Syria. They handed over their life savings in hopes of making it to Europe and starting over in a better place. None of the vessels they were loaded into had lights, flare guns, or safety equipment. Bottles of water and cans of tuna, if offered at all, were sold by the smugglers for $100 apiece. Rarely was enough fuel provided to make the trip, just enough to sail beyond Libyan territorial waters. Of course, the smugglers didn't do any of the actual transporting themselves. Instead, they selected one or two passengers, often at gunpoint, handed them a satellite phone and a compass, and then sent them out into the open ocean. In case of emergency, which was smuggler speak for when your boat runs out of fuel or falls apart and begins to take on water, the satellite phone had been pre-programmed with the emergency phone number for the Italian Coast Guard. Even though the Europeans were operating a massive interdiction operation in the Mediterranean, they didn't have enough assets to be everywhere. Under good weather, the smugglers were launching 10 to 15 boats a day up and down the Libyan coast. Under bad weather, they still launched, though fewer boats. Passengers along the route died from drowning, hypothermia, disease, starvation, shark attack, rape, beatings, and even murder. Harvath had read harrowing accounts of people being reduced to eating toothpaste and drinking urine to stay alive, of women thrown overboard because observant Muslim men suspected them of menstruating and therefore being unclean, of people being packed so tightly in sweltering holds below decks that they all suffocated. The inhumanity of the smugglers, and even some of the passengers themselves, was on par with barbarity he had only seen in war. And at the very top, the worst of the worst, was the man he had come looking for, Libyan smuggler Umar Ali Halim. Plenty of Halim's customers never even saw the water, much less a boat. He was notorious for splitting up families, selling women and children into the sex trade, or forcing them into his own private harem. Anyone who resisted, be they husbands, mothers, fathers, it made no difference, was dealt with on the spot. They were savagely beaten, sometimes even to death, as a warning to the others. Gang rape, lashings, being folded in his flying carpet, a board with metal hinges in the middle, meant to shatter the victim's spine, and other methods of torture spoke to Halim's depravity. In his line of work, Harvath saw killing men like Halim as a public service. It needed to be done, and required a willingness that not everyone possessed. He knew that there were people who objected even to the thought of what he did for a living. Every once in a while, he wished he could get them an up-close view of animals like Halim. Maybe then, they'd better understand not only what he did, but also why it was necessary. Harvath had voiced that desire to a handful of people, one of them being Reed Carlton. He still remembered the old man's response. "Everyone else wants to be appreciated. Not you. You're not looking for thanks. You want to be understood. That's what makes you different." He hadn't thought much about it at the time, probably because he didn't feel different. He figured everyone else felt the way that he did. The whole, "it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it" thing. But people did feel different. Not all of them, but enough. Not long ago, he remembered a colleague saying, "While most of us are trying to come up with a plan on how to get out, you're trying to figure out how to stay in." It was true. He had no desire to get out. He believed in what he was doing. And though he loved the idea of having a family, he didn't want to give up his career. That was probably the biggest difference he saw between himself and the guys who were looking to pull the ripcord. They had families. They wanted a life beyond slinging a weapon for a living. Those who stayed in usually did it because they needed the money or didn't know what else to do. Harvath, though, wanted to have his cake and eat it too. "Really bad idea. Exhibits D, E, and F coming up on our right," said Morrison, as they passed three more men in a pickup truck with a 50-caliber machine gun mounted in its bed, known as a technical. The Libya Liberation Front was a brutal local Islamist militia that provided protection for Halim and his smuggling operations. Even more unpalatable for Harvath and his team, though, was the fact that the Libya Liberation Front was aligned with Ansar al-Sharia, the al-Qaeda-linked group behind the attacks on a U.S. diplomatic outpost and CIA annex in Benghazi. They only numbered in the hundreds, but they had access to a ton of firepower. The last thing Harvath wanted was to tangle with them. It wouldn't end well. Get in, get the job done, get out without being seen. That was his plan. But as experience had taught him, things rarely went as planned. That was why McGee had made everything conditional on Harvath's bringing the team. Turning the corner, Haney piped up, cutting off Morrison and interrupting Harvath's train of thought. "Approaching target," he called out. 300 meters, left side. Chapter 12. The Europeans had chosen not to project force into Libya. That was their choice, but as far as Harvath was concerned, it was a mistake. Libya was in their backyard. The smugglers were pumping massive numbers of refugees into their countries. Hidden among those refugees were terrorists who were massacring their citizens.
It didn't seem like a difficult calculus. Why have a military, complete with special operations units, if you weren't willing to use it to take out threats to your nation? Fortunately, the United States didn't feel that way. From attacks on American tourists, embassies, and interests abroad, to attacks on its own homeland, the more terror was left to grow unchecked, the worse it was for everyone. Europe's problems today would only grow to become America's tomorrow. U.S. President Paul Porter had laid down a marker. If America's allies couldn't or wouldn't handle the metastasizing threats within their sphere of influence, the United States would. He understood that, like his own FBI, European intelligence agencies were overwhelmed. Nevertheless, their reluctance to get more aggressive was concerning. By clarifying his position, Porter was putting allies on notice that America would not sit idly by. In other words, if you see us operating in your neck of the woods, don't be surprised, and don't say we didn't warn you. Harvath liked and admired many of the European teams he had worked with over the years. He understood that an overwhelming bureaucracy had hamstrung them. Nevertheless, their nations were in a fight for their very lives. They needed to ask themselves some very difficult questions, and to do so quickly, beginning with, who were they, and what exactly were they prepared to do? It was the same question their enemy had already asked, answered, and was acting upon. If the Europeans had decided to go on the offensive in Libya, they would have started by focusing on the most accurate, most readily available intelligence. That was what Harvath had done, and the Italian Coast Guard had tapped into some of the best. In addition to a satellite phone, most smugglers provided Italy-bound migrants with a GPS device. There were plenty, though, who didn't. Far too often, the Coast Guard's Maritime Rescue Coordination Center in Rome received distress calls from terrified migrants who had no idea of their precise location, rendering a rescue next to impossible. Even when a caller had access to GPS, the center still needed to verify their position. The slightest deviation from the caller's actual location could mean the difference between life and death. Fortunately, the Rescue Coordination Center had access to an outside verification source. Abu Dhabi-based Thuraya was one of the largest satellite telecommunications companies in the world. Because of Thuraya's excellent coverage of the Mediterranean, Libyan smugglers bought all of their satellite phones from them. When the Italian Coast Guard received a migrant distress call, the first thing they did was contact Thuraya's emergency 24/7 hotline. In turn, Thuraya would do a quick search and provide the phone's GPS location. That cooperation had helped save tens of thousands of lives. Sometimes, though, the Italian Coast Guard was unable to get to a sinking vessel quickly enough. Such had been the case when the distress call from Mustafa Marzouk's trawler had gone out 6 days ago. It, too, the CIA had learned, had come from a Thuraya satellite phone. Harvath, though, wasn't interested in the phone's position when the call had been made. He wanted to know who had purchased the phone in the first place. While the CIA or their Italian counterparts could have requested the information from Thuraya, they doubted the Emirati company would comply. It was decided that the best and quickest way to access the data was to go take it. Thuraya's encrypted servers proved no match for the NSA, which soon delivered the information the CIA wanted. Of the 150 passengers on Mustafa Marzouk's doomed fishing boat, only three had survived. After they had been found, clinging to a piece of wreckage and pulled from the water, they all identified Umar Ali Halim as the smuggler who had sent them out into the impending storm. Halim's hideous reputation was well known by Italian authorities. What wasn't so well known was his location. The migrants he smuggled knew nothing about Libya. He changed embarkation points daily. Often, his men ferried the migrants out to their boats, which were already waiting for them a mile or more offshore. None of them could identify where they had been held or where they had specifically departed from. That's why Harvath had wanted to focus on the satellite phones. The phone used in Mustafa Marzouk's case had been part of a bulk purchase.
The purchaser didn't try to hide his location, nor did he bother to travel from Libya to the Emirates to pay cash and smuggle back the devices. Instead, the purchaser sat 11 kilometers southwest of the highly dangerous port city of Zuwara, clicking on the satellite company's buy button and running everything through a PayPal account flush with cash. The NSA had pinpointed his internet usage as the same location the phones had been delivered to. It was a hole-in-the-wall electronics shop, advertising cell phones, digital cameras, and laptop computers.
"Pull over," Harbath ordered.
Haney did as instructed. They observed the store as Harbath gave their communications gear a final check. Then, grabbing a black messenger bag, he opened the door and stepped out. It was the kind of hot, dusty street he had seen countless times over countless deployments. Squat buildings made of concrete blocks sat side by side. Sun-bleached awnings hung over faded, hand-painted signs in Arabic. In the little shade they provided, stacks of cheap crap sat for sale. There was sand everywhere. The entire town looked one breeze away from being swallowed up by the desert. Whether it was the heat or time for the midday Ka'ilula, few people were about. Even so, he didn't want to draw attention to the shop by leaving a vehicle idling out front.
"Find someplace close to park," he said.
Glancing into his side mirror, Morrison replied, "Don't be long. I don't like this place."
"Don't worry," Harvest stated, as he slid the door closed. "I don't want to be here any longer than we have to."
Chapter 13. Entering the store, Harvath took it all in. It looked as if it had been a small grocery, or maybe a pharmacy at some point. The walls were lined with empty metal shelves. In the back sat an empty soda cooler alongside an old freezer chest covered with ice cream advertisements. The cracked linoleum floor had been designed to look like alternate